He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the America Centrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. We all know that the Revolutionary War began with the battles of Lexington and Concord in April 1775, and that the Declaration of Independence proclaimed on the 4th of July, 1776, that the United States was an independent country. At this point in the war, it was still difficult to determine how many Americans were true patriots, how many were true loyalists, and how many were just sitting on the fence. Rough estimates, and these are rough, suggest that a third leaned patriot, a third leaned loyalist, and a third wanted to stay out of the conflict. But in the months after the 4th of July, real changes on the battlefields of North America started sorting out all of the colonists more decisively. War on your doorstep has a way of making you change your mind or take a stand. It forces you to run or stay and fight. One of the most significant developments in the summer and fall of 1776 that helped people pick a side was the capture of New York City by the British Army. And New York became the center of loyalism in the new United States, as loyalists fled there from far and wide to seek protection from Patriot militias and the Continental Army. So our theme today is loyalism in New York City. Why did the British Army choose New York City as a loyalist fortress? What do historical documents tell us about loyalist attitudes and beliefs? Why did colonists choose to become loyalists? How did loyalists react to the Declaration of Independence? And what happened to loyalists after the Revolution? Here with me today to help me answer some of these questions is Dr. Christopher Minty. Welcome, Christopher.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Minty is an early American historian and editor at the Center for Digital Editing at the University of Virginia, where he is managing editor and project director of Naval Documents of the American Revolution. He previously served as an editor at the Adams Papers editorial project, and he is the author of Unfriendly to Liberty, Loyalist Networks and the Coming of the American Revolution in New York City, published by Cornell in 2023. So the grievance you started off with, Christopher, he has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. That's, for me, a curious passage because it neglects sort of the other side of the coin, which is he was protecting at least some colonists, namely loyalists, right?
Yes. So throughout the colonies, loyalists were present everywhere. They were in all of the colonies and they came from all walks of life. White loyalists, black loyalists, indigenous loyalists, some were elite, many were not elite. And the stereotypical view of a loyalist or a Tory, as they were often labeled, is that they were high-ranking government officials or they were elite gentry, landed people who wanted to protect what they had and not risk losing everything. In reality, loyalists were very similar to those who became revolutionaries or patriots. They came from the same types of backgrounds. They shared the similar religions. They looked similar or the same. And they wanted to remain, for various reasons, within the British Empire under George III. In the Declaration of Independence, where you have the, you know, there's a long list of accusations against George III, they didn't mention that many people in the colonies wanted to remain under George III's protection. And he, as well as the British Army and the Royal Navy, went to great lengths, especially toward the start of the war and toward throughout, to keep them, to keep within the British Empire.
In your historical research, roughly when do we start seeing a divergence in views? Like, you know, the colonists are the colonists. We have the Seven Years' War. At what point does the opening rift start, would you say, where people start maybe identifying as I'm on this side and this will be called loyalism versus I'm on or tending towards another side of patriotism and independence?
That's a great question. Many textbooks or histories of the American Revolution often begin with the Stamp Act in 1765. It offers a neat, organized start to the march toward independence. It's 10 years before Lexington and Concord, and people often use that as the first step towards separating from Britain. And they highlight people who would become patriots, their contributions to the Stamp Act, the organization of the Sons of Liberty, but they often fail to mention that many leaders in New York City in the Sons of Liberty would go on to become loyalists. So you have people like Edward Nicoll, Joseph Alacoque, these were James Delancey. These were leaders among the Sons of Liberty in New York City, and they went on to become loyalists. In New York City in 1768 and 1769, there are General Assembly elections are held. Within these elections, a popular political group led by James Delancey and known as the Delancey faction take hold of the assembly. Toward the end of 1769, opponents to the Delancey start to emerge after they discuss the quartering of British troops in that city, because in New York it's the headquarters of the British Army. So there's a lot of British troops there and they need to have somewhere to stay. And New York has to adhere to parliamentary law or risk being essentially closed or shut down by Parliament back home. Prior to that, prior to those discussions, the Delanceys had built a viewing chamber in the assembly so that New Yorkers could literally watch their elected representatives do what they said they were going to do, which was advance their interests and protect them, advance economic independence, and look after their, basically just look after their needs. Do what, like, when they ran for election, they said they were going to do some things. They're building this viewing chamber was allowing New Yorkers to make sure that they were, you know, going to do that. They were doing that. When they were discussing the quartering of British troops, they locked the doors and didn't let anyone in. So this started the formation of an opposition group or faction led by a Scotsman called Alexander McDougall, who had been going to the assembly, he said, on a daily basis. And after that, after they discussed and voted on the quartering of British troops, he authored an anonymous broadside to the betrayed inhabitants of New York. And in that broadside, he made a series of allegations against the Delanceys and the acting governor called Cadwallader Colden, saying that they had formed an alliance and they were looking only to advance their personal interests and their personal needs. Now, Colden was acting governor during the Stamp Act crisis of 1765, and there were riots in New York in which Colden had quite a decent amount of property destroyed, and he was probably the most hated man in New York at that time. And people still didn't like him a few years later. So by tying the Delanceys to Colden, they were sort of painting them with the same brush. There were negative connotations all surrounding Colden were applied to the Delanceys. And a manhunt began to try and find the author of this broadside, and they eventually found McDougall, and he went in jail. They imprisoned him. And through his imprisonment, he was able to mobilize a huge amount of support for him and against the Delanceys. So it's around that point in 1769 up into 1770 where two opposing political groups form in New York. One, the Delanceys, and one is led by Alexander McDougall. McDougall eventually gets out of prison, and he goes on to lead this group in opposition to the Delanceys. But at that time, it's when the lines in the sand are almost drawn in New York, because most of the Delancey supporters would go on to become loyalists during the American Revolution. Most of McDougall's supporters would go on to become revolutionaries or patriots. So this is a long time before 1773, 1774, 1775, but the lines are drawn. So it's pre-existing political divides in New York centered around competing visions of their place within the British Empire at that time. They don't set them in stone, but they strongly influence people's allegiances during the revolution. And when 1774 and 1775 sort of come along, Delancey supporters are talking about this. They're talking about their opponents led by MacDougall, who they call the Blues. And that's where the divides emerge.
What do they call him?
The Blues.
The Blues?
They take many of MacDougall's supporters were Presbyterian, and that's how they label them, and they criticize them from that sense.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Not blue because that's the color of the Scottish flag.
No.
Or the flag of St. Andrew.
There was a little bit of like Scotophobia, especially directed toward Colden, because Colden was from Scotland too. But there wasn't too much directed against MacDougall, which is curious. When he was in prison, MacDougall appropriated the number 45 after John Wilkes, who authored the 45, the issue of the North Britain that got him in a lot of trouble back in England. And Wilkes was known for his anti-Scottish.
I have a number of different questions in that fascinating story that really shows that there are political divisions or ideological divisions preceding some of these other events leading up to the Declaration of Independence and the split between Loyalists and Patriots. First, why was MacDougall arrested? Was there no freedom of speech, the press?
He was arrested because they thought it was seditious libel. He was very critical of Colden and very critical of the Delanceys, and they didn't like that. And they wanted to find who the author was and put him on trial for putting out all of these, what they viewed as awful lies.
And he was released because the trial proved that what he said was true, or did he never make
it to trial? He was released more like a technicality, because the printer who published it died, and there wasn't really enough to convict him, so he was released. So he kind of got off, but he was imprisoned for a while. But through his imprisonment, he was able to mobilize a huge amount of support, so it kind of backfired on what they were trying to do. And his case would have been like, everything I've said is true. You can't convict me for saying true things.
Right. Another question I had was the extent to which these differences are personal, because it sounds like there is some personal animosity here. How much is it really just about self-interest, economic interest, and money? And how much of it is loyalism because of some love, deep-held love you have for the British king and British culture and tradition and some patriotic sense in that respect?
At that time, I think it had very little to do with any views about separating from Britain or anything like that. They shared competing visions for their views within the British Empire and New York City's role within it, and what elected representatives should and could do to advance and protect New Yorkers' interests. MacDougall thought that the Delanceys, especially those who had been elected, were working against the needs of ordinary New Yorkers, and thus they were somehow corrupt and should be essentially removed from office and other people should replace them. The Delanceys, perhaps being a bit more practical because they were in office already, were working toward trying to secure and protect New Yorkers' interests. And they knew that they had to discuss the Quartering Act at that time. And prior to doing that, they met with one of their supporters, who is a man called Isaac Sears. Isaac Sears would go on to become a prominent patriot during the American Revolution. But at that time, he was one of the Delanceys' most fierce advocates and had helped them get elected in 68 and 69. And Sears had recommended that if they're going to do this, if they're going to move forward with the Quartering Act discussions, then they tie on another bill to it. Kind of like what happens in modern politics today. Like when people are discussing something in Congress, then they might attach on something else. And he recommended attaching on a paper currency bill. So New York was in the middle of a bit of an economic downturn, or maybe you could perhaps call it a hangover after the 7 Years' War, the French and Indian War, because during that time, lots of Royal Navy ships had been in New York's harbour. Lots of British Army soldiers had been in New York City. So they'd all left, or many of them had left, because the war had ended. And having more money inserted into the economy, the local economy, would allow New Yorkers to pursue economic independence. So they would be able to stand more solidly on their own two feet. And so the Delanceys moved forward with that. In the end, it kind of backfired because they had shut people out of the assembly. So it was more, I feel that the Delanceys were trying to be more practical at that time. And McDougall was more of a, maybe not, I don't want to say an idealist, but leaning more toward that. But at that time, they were both Whigs. There were no real Tories, like capital T Tories, in New York City or across the colonies at that time. It was just, they were at different places on like a political spectrum. So you could say that the Delanceys were perhaps more moderate, or maybe like an establishment Whig. And their equivalents in Britain would be someone like the Marquess of Rockingham, who repealed the Stamp Act but passed the Declaratory Act, or Edmund Burke at that time. And for McDougall, his equivalents, he was more of a radical Whig. So Pitt the Elder, the Earl of Chatham, someone like him, were a radical Whig. Isaac Barry as well, or even someone like John Wilkes as well. So they were more radical. So it was different places on a political spectrum where they were, and they were just clashing at that time. And like as the colonies in New York City sort of came toward 1773, 1774, 1775, their positions became more entrenched, whereas the people in New York the Delanceys started to look toward Parliament or look toward people like Edmund Burke and Rockingham for support and to address their grievances. McDougall and his supporters started to look to other colonies. They started to look toward people like Sam Adams and up in Massachusetts. And then when John Adams was in the city, McDougall kind of latched himself onto him and showed him around the whole city to build intercolonial support. And they found like people who were like-minded, and they started to pursue their objectives together.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it made me think of what you were saying about people who are in the Sons of Liberty eventually sort of breaking towards loyalism. So can you just kind of explain how that process might have taken place? If there are any generalities we can draw from it.
So the Sons of Liberty were formed generally in 1765 as a result of the Stamp Act. They were formed all over the colonies. New York City was no exception. And the traditional narrative is that the Sons of Liberty were kind of a precursor to patriotism during the American Revolution. In reality, in New York, some of the leaders of the Sons of Liberty, also known as the Liberty Boys, would go on to become loyalists. And the Delanceys in New York were leaders in the Sons of Liberty. So in 1765, everybody in New York, with the exception of someone like Cadwallader or Colden, was against the Stamp Act. It wasn't something that was supported by people who'd go on to become loyalists. They wanted it repealed. They pushed for its repeal, and when it was, these people who had come together in 1765 would come together again in 1768 and 1769. And their political ties that brought them together broadened into personal ties. People started investing in land together. They started investing in other sort of commercial ventures together. People's family networks overlapped because they married each other's family members. And their opposition to Parliament trying to reorient the British Empire, their attempted reorientation of the British Empire, people who became loyalists opposed that as well. They didn't support the Tea Act, the Coercive Acts. They wanted them repealed too, just like people who became patriots. But the way that they wanted change to happen, the way that they wanted things to move forward, became different to those who became patriots. Patriots then started to look toward what the Delanceys viewed as like illegal or extra legal committees and congresses for redress. So they started to look toward eventually the Continental Congress, whereas people who became loyalists, the Delanceys, they still supported the New York General Assembly, their petitioning to Parliament and to George III, because that was the legal way to do it. These were their elected representatives. This is how we should do it, because if we go about it this other way, then people in Parliament and George III, they're not going to be too happy about that, because they haven't sanctioned this. This is a rebellion. So that's not the way that we should go about it. We should go through the tried and tested routes that we've used before. We've done this before. It worked with the Stamp Act, and then the Townshend duties as well. So this is the way that we should do it. Colonies had an agent in Parliament to advocate and support their interests. New York's agent was Edmund Burke, and the Delanceys had advocated and supported his appointment. So James Delancey, who's the de facto leader of the Delancey faction and family, he corresponds with Burke, he corresponds with Rockingham. Not only does he talk about politics with Rockingham, they share a deep love of horse racing. In 1765, so not long after the Stamp Act, and the Stamp Act should have come into effect in November, he writes to Rockingham and suggests setting up an American Parliament, because he says that, like, if you don't listen to what the people in the colonies are saying, they're going to exhaust you. Like, the colonies should operate independently for the most part, but rely on Parliament and the British Empire more broadly, for security, so for protection, things like the Royal Navy and the British Army. Going forward to 1775, Delancey still believes in this, and he still believes in New York's role within the empire, but he understands the situation that they're in. So he decides to travel across to England to essentially petition in person. So he goes in May of 1775. The timing is not great, because by the time he gets over, things have worsened, and he ends up never returning. But his initial goal is to advance the New York Assembly's view that the coercive act should be repealed, and there are certain things that the legislatures across the colony should be able to do. He's obviously just focusing on New York's, but things get ahead of him, and things happen quicker than he can control. He's going across the Atlantic on a tall ship. It takes a long time.
And right after the battles of Lexington and Concord.
That's right.
Is that what precipitates his departure?
No. It's really the Continental Congresses that motivate this sort of move, because they see what's happening. They know that, like, momentum is picking up, but the New York Assembly does not endorse the First Continental Congress. It doesn't, like, want to appoint representatives to the Second Continental Congress, because the General Assembly is the legal legislature in the colonies, and that's how they should move forward with seeking redress. And he just thinks that, within the Delanceys more broadly, think that going in person could be more effective. And you think it would be, because, like, Benjamin Franklin had a lot of success when he was in London. Delancey doesn't enjoy that same success.
Interesting. So let's move the story now from Lexington and Concord to the Declaration of Independence, focusing on New York. So the British Army is stationed in New York City, which is a good reason to be loyalist at the time. But the focus and the sense is that most of the radicalism is in Massachusetts, and specifically in Boston. So how are people in New York, the Delanceys and maybe even McDougal, how are they thinking about, and maybe also the average New Yorker, how are they thinking about what's going on in Boston and Massachusetts, say, from Lexington and Concord till the 4th of July, 1776?
So what happens for Delancey supporters? At that time, people who were patriots or revolutionaries essentially take control of Manhattan. They take political control of the city. The General Assembly is inert. It has very little political power. The royal governor eventually takes shelter on a ship in the harbor, and people like McDougal and his supporters are in charge. There is a mass exodus from the city, where the population falls, and supporters of the Delanceys are among that group who leave. So there's a prominent Delancey supporter called Frederick Rhinelander. Rhinelander had been a longtime supporter of the Delanceys, and he and many of his friends and colleagues leave the city and go over to New Jersey in Bergen County, and what's called in the English neighborhood. And they go there and they settle there, and Rhinelander is mentioned in a letter to George Washington as a dangerous person. He's a Tory. He's not with us, so we have to keep an eye on him and his friend Benjamin Huggett. Huggett is also a Delancey supporter. And so they're just trying to kind of stay away from McDougall and his supporters, because back in the city, they're trying to ensure compliance. Like, you're with us, so you have to fall in line. And that's what they do. They start threatening people if they don't want to sign the Continental Association, if they don't want to support their methods or their political views, so people leave. McDougall has had a long time sympathy and support for the people in Boston. In 1774, he, with Isaac Sears and John Lamb, if you remember, Sears was a supporter of the Delanceys in the late 1760s, and so was John Lamb. They abandoned the Delanceys in support of McDougall, and they start corresponding with Samuel Adams in Boston. And through their correspondence is when the suggestion of a Continental Congress is brought up. So they start to form an intercolonial relationship. And McDougall, who I think is probably one of the most understudied and underappreciated revolutionaries during this period, is a smart political actor. He recognizes the opportunity and the importance of aligning with the people in Boston. Going forward, the British Army and Parliament more broadly recognize the strategic significance of New York City. Not only is it one of the largest cities in the colonies, it has arguably the best harbor in the colonies with the Hudson River. And if they were able to take the city, they would essentially split the colonies in two, because they would be able to isolate the people in Massachusetts from many people sort of below New York City, so especially people from the south. And they would be able to access, going up the Hudson River, lots of ways to get into other colonies up there and to make sure everything is okay. But by cutting off Massachusetts and having control of New York's very large harbor, it would give them an opportunity to quash the rebellion quickly, and that's their goal.
So New York City is primarily a strategic point of interest. They didn't choose New York City because there was substantial loyalism there already. As you said, many of the loyalists had gone to New Jersey, so it was like strategically more important. They figured maybe they could find a little bit of support. But if McDougall and his band are kind of in control of Manhattan, then, you know, that paints a little bit of a different picture.
Yeah. New York City has often been described as like a hotbed of loyalism. And there are more loyalists in New York than anywhere else. And they'll look toward sources like the Loyalist Claims Commission. The Claims Commission was a way for exiled loyalists to seek compensation after the war, and there were more claimants from New York than anywhere else. I don't buy that, because of the political opposition of New Yorkers to Parliament's reorientation of the British Empire before the war. After the British take control of the city, loyalists flock there because it becomes a safe place for them to be. It offers them like protection. And after the war, there are lots of people in New York who are having to leave, and thus we have more New York claimants than anywhere else. There are also some prominent New York loyalists who people in Parliament and across Britain know, and they play an outsized role in the development of loyalism in the city. I'm thinking of people like James Delancey, who's left, people like Miles Cooper, who was the president of King's College, which is now Columbia. He also fled, and he went to England, eventually settles in Edinburgh in Scotland. but people know him as well, and he leaves. And then you have people who stay in the colonies, like Charles Ingalls, who ends up writing a number of loyalist documents to mobilize support. And he corresponds heavily with Miles Cooper during the war. And then you have other New York loyalists like Samuel Seabury, Frederick Phillips, who are very prominent. And these people kind of play an outsized role in some historians' views about the development of loyalism in New York.
So by the end of December 1776, New York City is under British control, right? So at that point, word starts spreading that if you're a loyalist feeling under threat, come to New York. This is now your safe haven.
Yeah. So one of the sources that I've used heavily throughout my time researching loyalism in New York are oaths of allegiance. And the oath of allegiance is tendered to New Yorkers in Manhattan, in Brooklyn, Staten Island, Long Island. And the oath of allegiance for Manhattan in particular presented some challenges when I was working on it, because when I was transcribing this list, it has thousands of names and it has their occupations. And I wanted to find out as much information about these people as possible. Who are they? How old were they? What religion were they? What occupation did they have? They had occupations there. I think the best one was a rum taster that I was able to find. It sounds like a fun job. Or a chocolate maker. So I've researched these people, and I've been researching the city for a while. So there was lots of names that I recognized. But there were also lots of names that I didn't recognize. And, you know, you have the John Smiths, William Smiths, that are very difficult to identify. But there were some names where I was able to do research, and I was fairly sure it was people from other colonies. And it's difficult to prove that with a high degree of certainty, because unless you have a document or documents that say, I'm going to New York City because X, Y, and Z, is hard to verify that. But I had strong suspicions that people from Virginia, from Maryland, from other colonies in the South or other colonies in the Mid-Atlantic had come to the city seeking protection. And because they were loyalists, that's where they felt that they should be, because they couldn't be in somewhere in Virginia, or they couldn't be somewhere in Pennsylvania or wherever, because they were loyalists, or they were viewed as loyalists, and being in the city offered them safety. They could protect their family or families, and that was just the best place for them to be.
And many of the people in New York City too, of course, the radical patriots would have left or been expelled, but there still has to be a significant percentage of the population that is sitting on the fence still and just is like, well, I live in New York City and I work here, so I'm just going to stay here.
Yeah, I think that the number of people who, I don't want to say flip-flopped because that's a bit glib, but people who, whoever was there at the time, that's where they were, their allegiance lay. That was present not just in New York City, but across the colonies. So you have, for example, to go back to an oath of allegiance, the oath of allegiance on Long Island. Long Island was also occupied at this time. People who were members of the Culper spy ring, like someone like Selah Strong, or the members of the Roe family, they took the oath of allegiance as well. These people weren't loyalists, and they had, you know, might have had other reasons for remaining because they wanted to perhaps retain their cover. But there are people who signed the Continental Association, a document that could be used to identify people as patriots, who also took the Oath of Allegiance, a document that could be used to identify people as loyalists, because they just wanted to carry on their everyday lives. They just wanted to survive. And I would say that those people, not just in New York or the city or on Long Island, those people outnumber the numbers of people who were patriots and the people who were loyalists, because they just wanted to, you know, live their everyday lives. And for some, having the British Army there was a commercial opportunity, because they could sell, like, big, large professional army turns up on your doorstep or turns up in your town, and you might sell some supplies and provisions. Well, these people are going to need those supplies, and they're going to need those provisions, and you could be more than happy to provide. And there's a really good example in Manhattan in particular, with a silversmith. And the silversmith, prior to the British occupation, is making swords that, you know, champion the American cause. And the, you know, swords have the ornament at the top, and they're very proud to be American, pro-American and anti-British. When the British come, he's printing like "Long Live George III" on his swords. And so he just completely flips. And that's, he recognizes the commercial opportunity there, but he also just wants to live his life.
There's one strand of history that says actually the presence of the British Army in New York City over the course of months, the occupation of New York City, if you will, actually wasn't everything that the Loyalists and the people who were sitting on the fence had hoped for. That as it turned out, the British Army being there, this being the Loyalist fortress, wasn't what they had bargained for. What do you make of that?
That's totally right. That's completely right. They declared martial law in the city and started to limit people's opportunities to do what they wanted. And they didn't return the city to the way it had been prior to the conflict. So that a really good book by Rima Chopra called Unnatural Rebellion gets into this in real detail about how Loyalists became frustrated with what was happening. And they were writing to people, like British officials, to try and fix things or turn things around. And the British had other priorities. They were looking to quash a large, what was becoming a worldwide imperial civil war. And this was just one component of it. And they just wanted to focus on that. So Loyalists kind of band together and try and offer support to their, you know, friends and other Loyalists in the city. But the British Army's presence doesn't give them what they hoped or anticipated.
Interesting. Maybe one final question about the loyalty oaths. As I've been thinking about this over the course of a couple months now, whenever I think of the loyalty oaths, I always think of an intelligence failure. The loyalty oaths turn into evidence that can be sent back to the decision makers in London, and it can prove to someone sitting there that there are these pockets of loyalism, and here we have some loyalty oaths to prove it, so all we have to do is just maintain course here, and the rebels will be stamped out. That's not what happened, right? So what is your sense of the loyalty oaths, sort of, as they're received in London and by generals even? Do you think they were misinterpreting them?
In New York, the royal governor at the time was a guy called William Tryon. And Tryon had previously been governor of North Carolina, and he became governor of New York in the early 1770s. And he replaced Lord Dunmore, who became Virginia's governor. And Dunmore didn't want to leave. He was desperate to stay in New York, and there's a lot of correspondence from him basically refusing to leave. Eventually he does, and Tryon becomes governor. When the war starts, like, Tryon goes back to England a couple of times for health reasons, but when the war starts properly and a military conflict has started, he desperately, desperately wants a military appointment. Part of me feels that when he had to take his government aboard a ship in the harbor in New York, he was embarrassed because it didn't really reflect well on his, you know, gubernatorial abilities. These loyalty oaths that he is present at, I think, are an attempt by him, like you say, to show people in Parliament, like, look how many loyalists there are. Look at this, like, this beautifully created document with thousands of names. They're either organized by town, like on Long Island, and they have their ages and occupations, or in Manhattan, it has all of their names, all, like, the calligraphy is gorgeous. It has all of their occupations, and they're all alphabetical. It's like, look how many loyalists there are here, and look at how good a job I'm doing organizing these loyalists. So he has them all sent over to George Germain, who's kind of Secretary of State for the colonies, as an attempt to prove or show New York is loyal. What's happening in other colonies? Not my problem. I'm not the governor there. I'm governor of New York. Look how many loyalists there are. And that's a part of the reason why people start to look toward New York. And they're like, okay, well, we'll go to New York. There could be a lot of support here, maybe militarily, in loyalist provincial regiments. And there are lots of New York-based loyalist provincial regiments. And in terms of, like, the real impact in Britain, I think it's comparatively minimal, because they're not just thinking about New York, they're thinking about all of the colonies together. And Tryon does get his military appointment, but I don't think it has the impact that he would have hoped. But for historians, these sources are fantastic, because not only do they offer long lists of people who you can explore individually and collectively, some of them offer like biographical information that you can see. You can see that loyalists were not all elites. There were farmers, there were shipwrights, there were silversmiths, goldsmiths, blacksmiths. They had tailors and the rum taster. Like almost any occupation that you could think of in the colonies were represented in these documents. And they're not straightforward either. You can look at these documents as lists of loyalists. All of these people who signed these documents were could be identified as a loyalist. But by doing sort of the individual research on these people, like the members of the Culbertes Byroning, you see quite quickly that these are complex documents that you have to handle carefully. Because if you take them at face value, you overlook the complexities of not only loyalism, but allegiance and political identity more broadly. And that's something that I've been grappling with a lot over the past several years, because when I first looked at these documents, when I was trying to identify as many loyalists in New York as possible, I thought I'd had, like, this is the gold mine. This is the best sources I could ever find. Let me find more oaths. But the deeper that you dig into them, you see that they are intricate, and you have to be able to navigate people's individual decisions, and you have to be able to try and track that. And it's not always possible. You won't always be able to find sources to tie things together and make them shake hands. But when I saw people from the Culbertes Byroning, or people who signed the Continental Association and then took the Oath of Allegiance, or you'll see someone like the son of a very prominent New York patriot take the Oath of Allegiance in Manhattan, it's probably just because he was there at that time and he was like, I don't want to be put on the Jersey prison ship in New York Harbor. No way. No sirree. I'll sign this document. And that's what makes them is so fascinating to me as well. It's just their complexity.
And just the most famous example of the switching of sides, but this was, well, people argue, but Benedict Arnold, who fought on the Continental Army side at the start and then became a loyalist at the end of the war.
Oh, yeah.
So let's talk about the end of the war now and what's happening in New York City with the loyalists. So what's it like to be a loyalist, a true loyalist, not one who just signed the oath for fun? War comes to the end. What's it like being a loyalist in New York City? How desperate are we?
You know, if we're in 1783, toward the end, Treaty of Paris has been signed, and the British are getting ready to leave. They're evacuating the city. Now, if you're a loyalist, really you have two options. The first option is to leave with the British. And thousands of people did this. Historians estimate that maybe up to 60,000-ish loyalists left the colonies total. Many of them went to what is now the Maritimes in Canada, set up New Brunswick. Many New Yorkers did this. Like George Duncan Ludlow, prominent New Yorker, went to New Brunswick. The Purdy family from Westchester went to New Brunswick. Underhills also went up to Canada. Some went to Nova Scotia. Others went over to England, settled in London. Many loyalists stayed nearby. They stayed in an area called Mortlake. They stayed near each other because if you're abandoning your life, it might make things easier if you're around people that you know. So many moved there. Some set Miles Cooper, the prominent loyalist who was president of King's College, settles in Edinburgh. Other loyalists moved to the Caribbean, and many black loyalists moved to Africa. The other option is to stay, at least at first, just see what happens. And thousands of loyalists do this too. And someone like Frederick Rhinelander, who signed every loyalist document that I've looked at, he stayed. The Late family, so William Late, Edward Late, also signed every loyalist document that I've seen. They also stayed. So they kind of said, okay, we'll take that risk and we'll stay. And we'll see if we can acclimate or adjust to life in these United States, these independent United States. Many of them acclimated, and they stayed, and their loyalism or past loyalism was looked over or eventually forgotten. And for someone like Rhinelander, he went on to become one of the most prominent New Yorkers in the city. He was ended up socializing with the Astor family, like the Astor family. And when he dies in the early 1800s and death notices or obituaries are published in the press, there's no mention of his loyalism. He was a good New Yorker. He did a lot for the city commercially, helped advance it, and his loyalism was forgotten. Now, some people in New York helped with that. Someone like Alexander McDougall pushed part, Alexander Hamilton, McDougall had died by that point, but Hamilton pushed hard for loyalists not to be persecuted, because why? Many New York loyalists had had their land confiscated and it was eventually sold off. So someone like James Delancey, he owned a lot of property on what is now the Lower East Side. His land was all confiscated. So him trying to move back to these United States would have been difficult. Rhinelander didn't have that. So he was able to acclimate easier than someone like Delancey would ever have been able to.
Was Delancey's property confiscated as punishment, and Rhinelander's not because he chose to stay and manage this?
Delancey's was confiscated earlier during the conflict because they identified and targeted him as a traitor. So they confiscated his land, and he wasn't the only one. There were other prominent loyalists who had their land confiscated, and eventually it was sold off. But Rhinelander wasn't prominent enough or didn't have enough land to be in the city anyway, to be confiscated.
What other types of retribution might a loyalist in New York City expect, if any? I mean, Rhinelander seems to be an example of someone who got off scot-free, we might say. But was there other types of retribution or vengeance, or no, not really?
Not to any like great extent that I've seen. There might have been some like political isolation or social isolation, but I think after many years of war, people were just looking to move forward. And these loyalists who remained were not looking to be troublemakers, and they were looking to just move forward. But that is an aspect of sort of the history of loyalism, the history of loyalists in New York City during the early Republic, that really does need more research done. Rhinelander, I think, is a bit of an outlier, but that research is something that certainly needs to be pursued by other historians. There are some work has been done on South Carolina. Historian Rebecca Brannan has done some wonderful work on how loyalists reintegrated there. But that's something that I would love to know more about, is like the extent to which loyalists were successfully able to reintegrate into everyday life in Manhattan. Because there are examples of other like sons of loyalists or other loyalists holding political office in New York. And like even one of Cadwallader Colden's descendants went on to hold office, became the mayor of New York City. And it's like, people forget, they're like, even with that last name, he was elected. But it's something that I would love to do more research on.
Dr. Minty, thank you so much for outlining the complicated history of loyalism in New York City. It's been really interesting, but we've come to the end of the episode today. And I ask all my guests, what is the main takeaway for you from this 250-year anniversary that we're celebrating this year of the Declaration of Independence?
I think that's such a good question. In talking to you, based in Germany, and in talking to friends and colleagues based in Britain and in France and in Spain, my main takeaway about 250 years of American independence is that it was truly a global war. This was a global imperial civil war that stretched across almost the entire world and touched not just thousands or hundreds of thousands, but probably millions of people's lives. And now where we are, historians are really grappling with that, the scale and scope of the war. And that's something that I think is just like, it's just awesome to see, like people researching the global dimensions of the war, how something that happens off the coast of India or like around Gibraltar affects what's happening in New York City or in Williamsburg, Virginia. It shows the extent to which this conflict affected the development of the geopolitical relations for hundreds of years.
Dr. Christopher Minty, thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been wonderful. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americacentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americacentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americacentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americacentrum.de. Thanks for listening.